And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to let you know that you probably need to gather up some paper and a pencil or something else to write with, because there might be something in this Earth First Update that you're going to want to write down someplace, sometime, somewhere. Something you want to look up, someplace you want to go. So let's start off with announcements. Here in Santa Cruz, on Sunday, November 9th, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Greg King will be giving a talk entitled The Fight to Save California's Last Wild River, and he'll be talking about the Smith River. This is all going to take place at the UC Santa Cruz Arboretum on High Street, west of Western Drive. Go up Bay Street till you get to High Street, turn left, and then the Arboretum is a little ways up on your right. Award-winning journalist Greg King presents his breathtaking photos of the Smith River in the far northwestern corner of California, while discussing the threat of pesticides and other impacts to this last of the state's wild rivers. The Smith River is the only major undammed river in California, and it is one of the cleanest and most beautiful rivers in the world. Scientists are relying on the Smith River to maintain healthy populations of salmon and steelhead in order to have viable wild stocks that can recolonize other California and Oregon streams into the future. Yet even on the Smith River, salmonids face an uphill battle against a damaged lower reach and against ongoing pesticide use on Easter lily farms that surround the Smith River estuary. Siskiyou Land Conservancy Executive Director and President Greg King has been active in California resource protection efforts since 1985. And one of the guys who started in on saving the Headwaters Forest. His investigation of illegal logging led to the eventual inclusion into the California State Park system of nearly 10,000 acres of forest land in western Sonoma County. In 1987, King discovered and named Headwaters Forest, containing the largest unprotected ancient redwood groves in the world, 4,000 acres of which are now permanently protected. King founded the nonprofit Smith River Project, dedicated to protecting California's wildest river. And in 2004, he founded Siskiyou Land Conservancy, an advocacy organization that serves five counties in northwestern California. King is currently writing a book, The Ghost Forest, A History of the Redwood Ecosystem and Redwood Logging and Protection Efforts. His last book, Rumors of Glory, the co-written memoir of Canadian rock star Bruce Cockburn, will be published in a week or so on Harper One. Once again, Greg King, talking on the fight to save California's last wild river, Sunday, November 9th, from 4 to 6 p.m. at the UC Santa Cruz Arboretum on High Street. So we'll be announcing that again next week. Moving to news from Germany, two blockades have been evicted from the Hambach Forest occupation. This story from the Hambach Forest blog, as found on the Earth First Newswire. The Hambacher Forest is the site of an ongoing land defense campaign in Germany. The forest sits at the edge of a lignite, that is brown coal mine, dirty stuff, and is under imminent threat from mine expansion. They write, today was another blockade of cutting and logging in the Hambacher Forest within the campaign No Tree Is Falling. At this blockade, the RWE Security, that's the company who owns the property, attacked the activists with batons and pepper spray. At this point, some activists got injured. In response, a second blockade happened to make the security and the loggers aware that they had injured activists. At this point, security attacked the activists harshly with batons and pepper spray. In addition, a logging machine headed directly towards the activists. During this attack, three activists were injured. One of them lost consciousness. Also, the RWE private security arrested three people. They choked them and bound them with cable ties. Activists defended themselves. After 1 hour, police showed up and arrested three more persons. Police came from the town of Duren and also arrested people. Will be taken there. If you're in Germany, they ask you to come around and support the blockade, show solidarity everywhere. That's what the people need here. And in France, a 20-year-old ZAD activist was killed in clashes with police at the Teston Dam resistance site. In this story from Revolution News, as found on the Earth First Newswire, 17 hours after police attacked the ZAD resistance in Testet, south of France, a 21-year-old ZADist was found dead. During the clashes, witnesses said they saw the man collapse and noticed the police were taking him away. On Saturday, October 25th, thousands of people from all over France gathered at Testet in opposition to the dam project and the violent repression of the ZAD resistance, which is ongoing for years but has increased in the past few months. Police attacked the protesters to remove them, and some militants battled the cops until late into the night. Police fired rubber bullets, tear gas grenades, and several protesters were badly injured. Later in the night, firefighters and police claimed they had found the body of a man in the woods, while eyewitnesses who were there say the body was found at a police roadblock. A witness said he saw someone collapse in clashes and being removed by the police, said Bren Lafette, spokesperson for the Collectives for Safeguarding Wetland Testet, during a press conference Sunday morning. Police blame the clashes on the resistance to justify the brutal repression they enforced on the protesters. The commander of the Gendarmerie Tarn, quoted by AFP, claimed that 100 to 150 anarchists masked and dressed in black threw incendiary devices and other projectiles at police surrounding a mobilization 2,000 opponents. In a statement, the Association Action for the Environment said, "Acting for the Environment can see that after several weeks of police violence indiscriminately and sometimes outside any legal framework, identity papers and personal effects were burned, disrespect for private areas. The police have once again made use of rubber bullets, stun grenades, and tear gas, and even though the event took place in a good atmosphere, the presence of the police at the end of the day will appear again for what it is, a provocation leading to a tragedy. According to preliminary information we have collected, the death took place in the context of clashes with the police at around 2 in the morning. We are not saying that the security forces have killed an opponent, but a witness we said the death happened during clashes. He told AFP by phone, Ben Lafette, spokesperson of the group Save the Wetland Teste, which includes most of the opponents of the dam project. We do not know more about the cause of the death. Contacted, the police prefecture did not want to comment. The prosecutor in Albi, Claude Derens, refused to make any comment before the results of the autopsy that will take place on Monday in the afternoon. And according to a source close to the investigation, the young man who died was 21 years old and was among those who were in the midst of clashes last night. Later information indicates that he was hit in the head with a tear gas grenade. That seems to be a common cause of death all too often. A late study shows that California water quality is being degraded by clear-cutting and salvage logging. A new study has documented that clear-cutting and post-fire salvage logging is degrading water quality in California. The report titled, quote, "An Analysis of Turbidity in Relation to Timber Harvesting in the Battle Creek Watershed, Northern California," unquote, was written by a statistical hydrologist, Jack Lewis, in partnership with the Battle Creek Alliance, a community organization that has been monitoring water pollution in the Battle Creek watershed. Lewis analyzed data from 1,700 measurements Battle Creek Alliance has collected for its Citizens Water Monitoring Project since 2009. Key findings of the analysis are, 1, increased turbidity, that is, the dirtiness of the water, is strongly associated with the amount of logging taking place in the watersheds that drain to the measurement sites. In watersheds that have been 30% cut, the average increase in turbidity is 200%. In watersheds that have been 90% cut, the average increase in turbidity is 3,000%. These changes are far in excess of the Water Board's turbidity standards for the Central Valley region. These findings led Lewis to conclude that, quote, "turbidity is the greatest in tributaries that have experienced the heaviest logging," unquote. Battle Creek Watershed is a tributary of the Sacramento River. It is located east of Redding in the foothills below Lassen Volcanic National Park. There's a $128 million project to restore endangered salmon in this watershed. However, there have been growing concerns about the impacts on these waters from the effects of clear-cutting and other forms of intensive logging in the watershed. In addition to cutting all or most of the trees in an area, clear-cutting can lead to increased soil erosion, which then muddies adjacent waters. Extensive clear-cutting in the Battle Creek watershed began in 1898 and continued in 2012 when there was a 27,000-acre fire in the area. Following the fire, the industrial timberland experienced widespread salvage logging, which was conducted under an exemption to the state forestry regulations that allowed for even more extensive cutting. Local residents have voiced concerns that the regulatory agencies have not properly addressed the cumulative effects on water, climate, fire behavior, and species diversity from this ongoing logging. Our regulatory agencies need to take action rather than ignoring the evidence, said Mary Lee Woodhouse, director of the Battle Creek Alliance. The study shows that clear-cutting and salvage logging are polluting California's waters. And moving to Southern California, highways are fragmenting habitat on the mountain lion gene pool. This story reported by Steve Gorman with editing by Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Analysis of DNA from 350 mountain lions or cougars, also known as puma, in the state of California revealed that those in the Santa Ana Mountains southeast of Los Angeles are only about half as genetically diverse as more robust populations in the Rockies. The Santa Ana Range is surrounded by an expanding population of about 20 million people, while a corridor linking cougar territory there to a bigger range and more lions to the east is cut off by a 10-lane highway. The highway and development around it prevent cougars from freely roaming between the ranges, restricting gene pool replenishment, University of California Davis scientists said in a study published in the journal PLOS One. The highway also poses a kill threat to lions, and DNA samples show the region's genetic bottleneck dates back about 80 years, coinciding with a period of tremendous human sprawl in Southern California. That tells us it's not just natural forces causing this loss of genetic diversity, it's us people impacting these environments, said Holly Ernest, a veterinarian and geneticist who co-authored the study. Low genetic diversity, as demonstrated by the endangered Florida panther in the Everglades, leaves a population susceptible to hereditary abnormalities such as heart defects and infertility. It also makes the population less resilient to environmental changes like drought and habitat loss. Combined with other factors like poaching, disease, or removal of cats deemed a public safety threat, a declining gene pool ultimately leads to an extinction vortex, Ernest said. The Florida panther presents a worst-case scenario that has seen millions of dollars spent trying to bring it back from the brink of extinction since the 1990s, said Winston Vickers, a UC Davis-based veterinarian and researcher who was primarily responsible for catching the lions used in the study. If we keep building without attention to these issues, we're going to keep creating more pockets of isolation, he said. Recovery measures might include construction of wildlife passages beneath the freeways, fencing to prevent road kills, and importing cougar from elsewhere to inject fresh DNA into genetically stranded populations, he said. The Santa Ana Mountains population is believed to be among the most vulnerable in California, where some 4,000 to 6,000 cougars are estimated to roam statewide. And threatened listing is good news for the western yellow-billed cuckoo in this story by Steve Holmer of the American Bird Conservancy. The American Bird Conservancy applauds the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decision to list the western population of the yellow-billed cuckoo as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. The listing, which will be published in the Federal Register, is expected to bring about the necessary protections for the imperiled bird species whose numbers have plummeted in recent decades. The final rule recognizes that current environmental regulations are inadequate to eliminate the threats faced by the western yellow-billed cuckoo, said Steve Holmer, senior policy advisor with American Bird Conservancy. Federal agencies must take responsibility for the water diversions and grazing policies that are harming the species. The listing tells federal managers to chart a new direction and develop a plan to restore riparian areas and regrow lost yellow-billed cuckoo habitat. The final rule, which will become effective November 3rd, says that collisions with towers during migration is also a significant threat to the remaining western yellow-billed cuckoos. The American Bird Conservancy urges that a program be adopted to educate and provide financial incentives for tower operation within the species range to adopt modern lighting known to reduce yellow-billed cuckoo deaths, said Homer. And you can find out further information at www.abc.org. And a lack of Arctic sea ice has forced some 35,000 walruses to chill out on an Alaskan shore. Reporting by Steve Quinn in Juneau, Alaska. Editing by Eric M. Johnson and Eric Walsh, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Walruses are accomplished divers and frequently plunge hundreds of feet to the bottom of the continental shelf to feed, but they use sea ice as platforms to give birth, nurse their young, and elude predators, and when it is scarce or non-existent, they have to haul themselves up on land. One of the differences between this haul-out and other ones is the sheer size and number of animals coming to shore, said U.S. Geological Survey ecologist Chadwick Jay. Since haul-outs in areas of the Chukchi Sea, which polar bears also use as platforms for hunting, were first observed along Russia's coasts until Pacific walrus masses began appearing on Alaska's coastline in 2007, U.S. scientists say. Researchers monitoring these patterns estimate as many as 35,000 walruses come to shore near the coastal village of Point Lay, about 700 miles north of Anchorage. Over the weekend, the tusked beasts can be more than 10 feet long and weigh 2,700 pounds. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist Joel Garlick Miller said the most pressing conservation concern with such a massive gathering is the possible mortality rate caused largely by stampedes. And the stampedes are caused by airplanes flying over, so they've banned aircraft in the area. The ice dissipation was likely attributed to changes stemming from global climate change, Jay said. The mass movement can be treacherous for younger walruses who can be trampled by a stampede triggered by aircraft or predators such as grizzly bears or polar bears, Garlick Miller said. Fish and Wildlife estimates of the Pacific walrus population are between 200 and 250,000 animals, although the exact number is unknown. And Brazil has declared a new protected area larger than Delaware in this story by Morgan Erickson Davis of Manga Bay, as reported to the Earth First Newswire. Recently, the Brazilian government announced the declaration of a new federal reserve deep in the Amazon forest. The protections conferred by the move will ban deforestation, reduce carbon emissions, and help safeguard the area's renowned wildlife. Named Alto Moaz, the new reserve encompasses 668,000 hectares, that's about a million acres, of mostly pristine forest void of human presence, according to the Brazilian Environment Ministry. The area is home to hundreds of species of animals, including 13 primate and 600 bird species. Of the area's primates, several are considered threatened with extinction by the IUCN. The red-nosed saki is one of these. Listed as endangered, the distinctive species needs large tracts of continuous forest, something that is becoming increasingly rare as deforestation fragments its range. One of the biggest threats to the saki is the development of roads in the area, which has brought with them an influx of soybean farms. This sort of activity will be forbidden in Alto Moaz. For conservation groups, the declaration of reserve is a boon for area wildlife. This is essential to protect unique Amazon species, such as some types of primates, Mauro Armelin, a World Wildlife Fund conservationist, told Reuters. However, the creation of a reserve was not motivated entirely for habitat protection. It is actually part of Brazil's climate policy. By granting federal protection to the area and thereby preventing large-scale clearing activities, the country hopes to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. Unlike most other countries whose carbon emissions are primarily due to the burning of fossil fuels, Brazil's emissions come largely from deforestation, which releases into the atmosphere carbon that had been locked up in trees. Once the world's largest deforester, Brazil has made huge gains in reducing forest loss, with a 70% drop in deforestation recorded over the past decade, saving an area of forest roughly the size of Maine. A study published in Science earlier this year found this deforestation reduction prevented the release of about 3.2 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions, the equivalent of removing all of the cars from U.S. highways for 3 years. Yet deforestation does still continue in Brazil, with Global Forest Watch data showing forest loss of more than 34 million hectares from 2001 through 2012. That is more than 6% of the country's tree cover. The new Alto Moés Reserve lies in the western state of Amazonas at its border with Pará. Together, the two states lost more than 640,000 hectares of forest in 2012 alone. While the forest contained within Alto Moés has been untouched with human development, Global Forest Watch shows that clearing encroaching into the area, with about 50,000 hectares lost in 2012 within a radius of about 150 kilometers from the new reserve. While designation as a protected area does provide certain safeguards, it's not an all-out guarantee. For instance, an environmental protection area about 400 kilometers from Alto Moés lost 361,000 hectares of tree cover from 2001 to 2012, according to Global Forest Watch. And for the first time in 70 years, a wolf has been spotted at the Grand Canyon. In this story by Kieran Suckling of the Center for Biological Diversity, as found in the Earth First Newswire. This incredible news comes just as politicians are gearing up to strip federal protections for most wolves in America, including this one in the Grand Canyon. Although the wolf is protected for now by the Endangered Species Act, that won't last long if the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has its way. The agency plans to strip protections by the end of the year, meaning this Grand Canyon wolf could be shot on sight. This could happen any day, but we're acting to stop it right now. This wolf's journey to the North Rim, likely over hundreds of miles, is exactly what's needed for wolves to return to their native homes and establish new territories with new families. We know there are hundreds of thousands of miles of habitat where wolves could live if we only let them. That's why we're celebrating what's happened in the Grand Canyon and deeply concerned about the survival of the wolf. We're just ending wolf hunting in Wyoming, and we recently won protection in California when OR7 became the first wolf in that state in nearly a century. That wolf now has a mate and pups and is living in Oregon. We know how to fight these battles and win. No single animal could more clearly demonstrate why it's a terrible idea to strip federal protections from gray wolves, yet across the West, bureaucrats and politicians are pushing this very agenda. While wolves are highly intelligent and social, they don't bother to read border signs, and none of the states in the Four Corners, including Arizona, offer them a haven. Indeed, the Arizona Game and Fish Commission has called for an end to federal protection for wolves. The Center for Biological Diversity is fighting to save and recover wild wolves by fighting state by state for wolf protection. As wolves return to their historic range, we will follow, bringing science, law, and activism to bear. We know how to protect wolves. Having our roots in the Southwest, we can't wait to hear the howls ringing once again through our canyons. Your help is critical. Please give now to the Center for Biological Diversity's Predator Defense Fund to win the fight for Western wolves. You can find this information and more on how to donate at www.biologicaldiversity.org. That's www.biologicaldiversity.org. And reversing the course on beavers, this story by Jim Robbins of the New York Times. Once routinely trapped and shot as varmints, their dams obliterated by dynamite and bulldozers, beavers are getting new respect these days. Across the West, they are being welcomed into the landscape as a defense against the withering effects of a warmer and drier climate. Beaver dams, it turns out, have beneficial effects that can't easily be replicated in other ways. They raise the water table along streams, aiding the growth of trees and plants that stabilize the banks and prevent erosion. They improve fish and wildlife habitat and promote new rich soil. And perhaps most important in the West, beaver dams do what all dams do, hold back water that would otherwise drain away. People realize that if we don't have any way to store water that's not so expensive, we're going to be up a creek, a dry creek, said Jeff Brunell, a scientist with the Wildlife Conservation Society in Bozeman, Montana. We've lost a lot with beavers not being on the landscape. For thousands of years, beavers, which numbered in the tens of millions in North America, were an integral part of the hydrologic system. These valleys were filled with dams as many as one every 100 yards, Mr. Burrell said. They were pretty much continuous wetlands. But the population plummeted, largely because of fur trapping, and by 1930, there were no more than 100,000 beavers, most entirely in Canada. Lately, the numbers have rebounded to an estimated 6 million in the United States. Now, even as hydroelectric and reservoir dams are coming under fire for their wholesale changes to the natural environment, an appreciation for the benefits of beaver dams, even artificial ones, is on the rise. Experts have long known of the potential for beaver dams to restore damaged landscapes, but in recent years the demand has grown so rapidly that government agencies are sponsoring a series of West Coast workshops and publishing a manual on how to attract beavers. We can spend a lot of money doing this work, or we can use beavers for almost nothing, Mr. Burrell said. Beavers are ecosystem engineers. As a family moves into a new territory, the rodents drop a large tree across a stream to begin a new dam, which creates a pond for their lodge. They cover it with sticks, mud, and stones, usually working at night. As the water level rises behind the dam, it submerges the entrance to their lodge and protects the beaver from predators. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can listen to a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio. You can also listen to Free Radio Edmonton at yegradio@wordpress.com. That's yegradio@wordpress.com, 2 p.m. on Saturdays and 10 a.m. on Sundays, and that is Mountain Time. Also in Mountain Time is Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, 90.3 KRFP, and you can hear a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update on Mondays at 9:30 p.m. You can also go to radioforall.net and listen online anytime, or you can download a podcast, radioforall.net, and they are a valuable archive for programs produced by independent programmers such as myself. Pirate and community radio stations, radioforall.net, could use your assistance. So please go to radioforall.net and click on the little banner at the top and make a donation to keep them going. Earth First Radio News is produced every Thursday evening right here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's a production of Earth First Radio News. I'd like to thank you for listening. And do tune in next Thursday evening right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz for another edition of the Earth First Update. Once again, thank you for listening.